Do you ever get tired of hearing a phrase repeated so often that it's not only annoying, it's like if you hear it one more time, your head's going to explode? I was reading an article this week on 30 of the most overused words that we need to stop using in 2019. And of those 30, I had three favorites. Perhaps you have some favorites you'd like to see go away as well. But my three favorites were these. First one is the word woke. Woke, not the sleepy woke, but woke as defined of a person who is tuned into issues of racial discrimination and injustice. Or the alternative definition is just somebody who is really with it. He or she is really woke. I hear it all the time with the millennials in my office, I've got to admit. My second favorite, and this one's a little more relevant to me being a sports fan, and that one is GOAT. Some of you know, so Frank shaking his head, some of you are going, GOAT? It's actually the initials, stands for greatest of all time. And you see it on the back of football jersey players like Tom Brady and other perhaps hockey players or other people who think that so-and-so is the GOAT, the greatest of all time. That's a word that could just go away and I'd be okay. Then there's a third that you're all familiar with, and I'm sure we would all love to hear this no more, and that is fake news. Needs no explanation. But one phrase that is not on that list that some would recommend is the phrase thoughts and prayers. As you can imagine, that phrase has been all over the internet this weekend due to the events in Virginia Beach. In March of last year, CNN published an article titled "How Thoughts and Prayers Went from Common Condolence to Cynical Meme." For those of you who don't know what a meme is a picture or a short little video on the internet that typically often makes fun of something. In this article, the author outlines a phenomenon called semantic saturation, where a word or phrase is repeated so often that, in essence, it loses all of its meaning. The article states that thoughts and prayers has reached that full semantic saturation point. This loss of meaning is illustrated by a story that was in the news late last year. Last November in Thousand Oaks, California, Mark and Susan Orfanos awoke to their phone ringing at 2 a.m. on a Thursday morning. It is a phone call that every parent prays they never get. After the call, they raced to the Borderline Bar and Grill, where a line dancing night for college students ended when a lone gunman opened fire shortly before midnight. Their 27-year-old son was there. He was one of the victims. The cruel irony of this story is that their son had been a survivor of the Las Vegas gun massacre only 13 months prior. These grieving parents channeled their anguish into a public plea. But what distinguished their plea was an utter disavowal of the stock response to the violence that claimed their son's life. She said on TV, "I don't want prayers. I don't want thoughts. I want gun control. And I hope to God nobody else sends me any more prayers," she said, vigorously shaking her head. You can imagine her grief, her anger, two experiences of gun violence with her son. One internet meme or picture that went viral after the Douglas Stoneman shootings shows a garbage truck unloading its load of trash at the dump, and on the side of the truck, painted in big letters, "Thoughts and Prayers." Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy called out the phrase's odd and complicated role. He said, "The thoughts and prayers of politicians are cruelly hollow if they are paired with continued legislative indifference." Thoughts and prayers. Sometimes we use these words because we don't know what else to say when bad news strikes somebody that we know and we love. We feel helpless to do anything. We can't fix it. There's no particular action that will make it better, and so we offer thoughts and prayers because sometimes, quite frankly, we don't know what else to do. We say it often in our religious context to acknowledge members in our community and that we share their pain. And while the Second Amendment continues to be in the headlines and serves to highlight the deep divisions in our country, we could add to that list what to do about the border crisis, recent restrictive abortion laws in various states, tariffs affecting incomes and consumers, and the general polarization of our political environment. Take your pick. Lots of targets for thoughts and prayers. And yet, in the midst of this climate, we read this morning's lectionary text for the last Sunday of the Easter season before Pentecost arrives next Sunday, from the Gospel of John, chapter 17, verses 20 through 26. Ironic as it may sound, the text is about unity. A timely word from the Lord, perhaps, for us, given all that is swirling around us. Here's what we know about the context of this story. The community that John was writing to was the third generation of Jesus' followers, probably written somewhere between 90 and 110 AD. Scholars write that the church was most likely facing its own set of divisive issues that threatened its unity. And so John, as he was writing, was trying to address this in the words that he wrote. Our text, 20 through 26, is part of a larger story known as Jesus' farewell discourse, where he gives his parting words and his final instructions to his disciples, knowing what he knows about what is about to unfold. During a final meal with his disciples in the upper room, he offers a prayer that is known as the high priestly prayer, and he prays for them, and he prays with them. And it is through this prayer that the gospel writer wants us to know something central about the divine character of Jesus before he leaves the stage and the Holy Spirit is sent. John is the only gospel writer of the four who highlights not just who Jesus is, but where he comes from. In this prayer, we see a glimpse of the Trinitarian relationship that existed before creation, the unity of love between the three persons of the Godhead, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, one God, three expressions. You can hear the witness to that relationship in the words in verse 21. "As you, Father, are in me, and I am in you, may they also be in us." The second element that John wanted us to know is that the unity that Jesus knew and experienced within the Godhead is a unity that he wants for us as a community. And so while he was, yes, praying for that particular community of believers at that time in history, knowing the divisive challenges they were facing. His prayer also transcends time. He is praying for us now, in our own particular divided time and place, and that we would experience this same unity in the midst of our divided world. Listen to the word again in verse 21, that they may all be one, as you, Father, are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. So that the world may believe that you have sent me. The key point is that through this experience of unity and through our intentional actions beyond thoughts and prayers, the world would see God. Given the events Friday in Virginia Beach, I was drawn to a story of how one community, in the midst of a horrific tragedy, combined their prayers with action. And in doing so, demonstrated to the world that the path to unity is indeed possible through a collective community witness. You may remember the tragedy 2006 in Nickel Mines, Pennsylvania. The Amish community where 10 schoolgirls, where a shooter shot and killed 5 schoolgirls, 10 were wounded, 5 were killed, before turning the gun on himself. The gunman was known as the local milkman. In a story that you can listen to on NPR's StoryCorps, the Amish community responded in a way that is unheard of in our time and our day. They not only forgave the shooter within hours, that was expressed, but they have grown close to his family. As the story is told, the gunman's mother, Terry Roberts, remembers driving to her son's home and finding a state trooper and her husband standing outside. "It was Charlie," her husband said to her. "I will never be able to face my Amish neighbors again." That week, they held a private funeral for their son. But as they went to the gravesite, to their astonishment, they saw as many as 40 Amish people coming from around the graveyard and surrounding them in a crescent. Families that had just buried their daughters the day before were in attendance. They hugged the widow and other members of the shooter's family. "Love just emanated from them," Terry says. And 1 month after the tragedy, it was announced that the Amish community had donated money to the killer's widow and 3 young children. 10 years later, in a follow-on story by NPR, members of the Amish community there revealed that their bold gesture of forgiveness did not mean that these 10 years or more have been easy. But they found unity through their unified actions. One of the community members offered these insights. "Tragedy changes you. You can't stay the same. Where that lands you, you don't know. But what I found out in my own experience is that you bring what little pieces you have left to God, and He somehow helps you make good out of it. And I see that happening in our tragedy. One simple thing that the whole world got to see was this simple message of forgiveness." As I listen to that story, I hear and I see the words of Jesus' prayer, that the world may believe that you have sent me. So Calvary, in the end, it doesn't matter what you say, thoughts and prayers or whatever, it matters what we do to demonstrate our unity through our shared witness. That is our mission. That is our challenge. And while the scandal of disunity persists, Jesus prays for us still. And he sends his Spirit as our companion to support us along the way. But that's a story for next week, Pentecost. Friends, this is the good news. Thanks be to God.